want insight and solutions? You're in for a unique experience, one where you're free to ask questions about where you're stuck, ask and hear questions of an everyday variety, global or personal, deep or ancient. All questions are welcome. Any human issue or problem is seen with a new awareness from Patricia's powerful understanding of whole brain thinking. Receive insights you never thought were possible, and be comforted to hear some insights you always knew were right. Discover the profound and the creative value that problems can give us. And now, Patricia's son.
Welcome to Trust the Problem. Today on Trust the Problem, I'm really going to talk about a huge problem. And it just came about because there's a convergence of, you know, I always follow the flow and how things are coming and moving. And this is so potent in America today, the problem of alcoholism. And with the recent DUI arrest of Mel Gibson, who I met once, by the way, spoke to him a little bit and was very impressed with him, actually. And this was a long time ago. This was when he did Hamlet. And I've noticed, you know, the things that have been going on lately in his career. And I think one of the things that I'm really going to be talking about is not only the problem of alcoholism and addictions in America, which is the big overview, and that's the problem that we're looking at today. But Mel Gibson has made himself an archetype, both in terms of art and talent, as well as whatever injury he has. And he knows that he's an archetype, and that when he goes through something or says something, it affects the world. But he doesn't always know it. He's a human being, as all archetypes are. They're still only human beings. When I say only, I don't mean that in any diminishing way. I mean it in a clarifying way. We are all only human. Even all the religious idealism in the world, and certainly in Christianity, we even still made Jesus human. And that even if he's the Son of God, he's human. And so this humanity is also what I want to talk about, because I do see America as going through a tremendous change. America is an archetype, an exemplar in nations, primarily because we are a wonderful amalgam of all the peoples of the world and all the religions of the world and all the different cultural histories and evolution in the world. And we are us, the U.S., us. And this usness is going through a process of becoming one nation. And it's always been going through a process of becoming one nation. And maybe that's an archetype for becoming one humanity, one species, one whole being, loving each part of itself to stay healthy. And perhaps that's the archetype, that's what I believe, actually, and that's where we're going. So getting back to Mel, and some of you know, I've counseled people in Hollywood and people who won Academy Awards, and I never mentioned names, so I won't now. And I certainly did not ever counsel Mel Gibson. I only met him very briefly and talked to him briefly and heard him speak to someone else who I was with at some length about his movie Hamlet. And I was very impressed with him, and I could feel him. And there's one of the things that there's a phrase for. Some of you may know that I was raised Irish Catholic. I am Irish, and my maiden name was Riley. And there is a thing. I remember seeing a documentary on the Irish in America, and there was this old Irishman being interviewed from Ireland, and he said, you know, there's always a Celtic tell, a Celtic tell. And there is such a thing. I've seen it with other people. I feel it when I meet people. It's a kind of, I don't know what you'd call it, sort of like a telepathy, but it's much more than that. It's not like just reading somebody's mind. It's a sensitivity. It's a kind of sensitivity. And I've also, by the way, encountered the same kind of sensitivity in Russian people, in black people, and I think in Jewish people sometimes, because I think people who've suffered a lot, who are sensitive already, run into this heightened sensitivity, capacity to size someone up or size something up. And not necessarily with all great wisdom in the world, but as a sense, as a perceptive ability. And when I say not all the necessarily the greatest wisdom in the world, it's because with that sensitivity often comes tremendous injury. And so our most sensitive people, our most sensitive children, our most sensitive individuals often are damaged in a very unique way. And it's also interesting, I don't even dare say this now, I thought that just crossed my mind. I remember as a little girl, I used to think, God, I think I'm a mutant. You know, I think I'm just a mutant. I think somebody just left me from another planet or something, because I keep seeing everything that people are doing, and they're lying, and they're not doing this, and they're doing that, and they're saying they're not. And it's so obvious. It's so transparent. And I used to think, how can everybody just keep be acting like it's not happening? Well, as I got older, you know, one of the things I realized, children tend to be able to do that. Not all children, but most children. Maybe all children, but some get it stomped out quicker or more effectively than others. But there is this sensitivity. So, remembering our subject today in Trust Problem, it's about alcoholism, addictions in general, and America. So I think America's culture is going through a huge change of trying to mature itself. And just as in family therapy, and I did family counseling for a number of years, and I actually left the clinic kind of setting and family counseling therapist setup, because I didn't really care for the medical model. My experience was, you know, the little book, the DSM, where you had to get a code number to put on the form about what the person's problem was. You know, it had to be made, quote, scientific, and it had to be given a label. And after looking at this huge list of numbers and labels, I just always picked, I can't remember the number now, but it was family problems. So I always picked family problems because it was always true. It was always family problems. And it didn't get into all this sort of pseudoscience labeling and boxing. Now, don't misunderstand me. There's some very good things that get labeled or structured or insights made in psychology and in medicine, and it can be helpful. It's not an all or nothing at all. It's just that there is a fair amount, maybe a lot, that is contrived and is a defense against being intimate and healing and sensitive and facing yourself, because a counselor can only be as helpful as they are wise themselves. Well, and even as I say that, I won't take it back, because sometimes inadvertently people who don't know what the heck they're doing just blunder in and say the right thing at the right time, and they are very helpful. So I take that back even as I said it. But if you get what I'm trying to say, it's not the training, it's not the labeling, it's not the boxing that makes therapy helpful. It's the connecting, it's the feeling, it's the releasing of grief through realization and experience. This is what causes the healing, both physically and mentally and emotionally. And we have so many defenses because of our immature style of thinking. As you hear me talk all the time, I believe we're in the midst of an evolutionary leap. It's the leap is our capacity. capacity to perceive is becoming greater. And the thing that blocks this capacity, which is truly inherent, but that blocks it, is a style of thinking that is a combination, immature thinking, meaning immature that we're young, immature that we haven't had enough experience yet, immature as a whole species, we really don't know what to do with all that we feel. And then the second thing is the conditioning, which tries to make it simplistic, black and white, so you can be right. And one of the things that brought me to do this show today and to mention Mel and to go into it a little, which I will as we hang out here, as I went online after I saw he got the DUI, and, you know, I felt so bad that I never contacted him again, never talked to him again, because I could feel it then. I could feel the passion, I could feel the intensity, and I don't mean this in any romantic way. I mean it in a tender, I don't know what's the right word for that great tender sensitivity that's very Celtic, by the way, and it is what all sensitive people carry in the core, and maybe there is a gene for it, and if there's any gene for alcoholism and drug abuse, it's probably that. And I've counseled people through the years, you know, addicted to different things, alcohol, cocaine, and other stuff, and the thing I have always noticed is that these people are incredibly sensitive, and simultaneously, they wish the world was wonderful. They wish the world was perfect. And it's so far from perfect, and they're in such pain because of that, they take drugs to numb out. Now, likewise, simplistic thinking, black and white thinking, is a kind of mental drug. It causes us to feel right, to feel righteous about being right. And as I started to say a little earlier, as I was doing this research on Mel, I came upon a book on his life, and it was just, you know, you just get to read little excerpts, and it was about his father saying about how great it was to be Catholic because at least you know you're right, and that he thought in very black and white terms, and all that passion, you know, the troubles in Ireland, the endless battle and the deep sensitivity and passion and sense of injustice. And you think of the Middle East and the Arabs and the Jews who are really, you know, brothers. They're both the children of Abraham. They have practically the same religion. They're each other's mirror. They do the same things to each other. They have the same faults. They have the same beauty. They have the same... They're so similar. And they project and project all their hurt and their pain and their woundedness on the other without the thought of self-correction. And, of course, this is how you end war. And this is also how you heal addiction. And this is America's big lesson. And the simplistic thinkers, and this is a psychological problem. This is not really about any ideology. It is the psychological mental defense of trying so hard to be right that you'll be blind, and you will get injured when you do that. Life will be unjust and unfair, and you will be angrier and angrier, and you will not know what to do with it except project it out on somebody else if you don't have the mental sorting ability to be able to reflect and contemplate and look back at yourself. So this is the problem. This is really what the problem is. And what brought me to all this, and about including America, was that I was looking up the word dry drunk. And I have said on the air, and I've said in workshops, you know, our president is a dry drunk. And this is an expression, I don't know who invented it or how long ago, but it's when somebody who's been a heavy drinker, which is just a euphemism for being an alcoholic, but if you have money or fame or status of some kind, you can have it converted from alcoholic to heavy drinker. And then it is a way to deny or minimize that you're really kind of trapped in an unhealthy thinking style and that you're using a drug to help you maintain, to keep up the unhealthy thinking style. And it's inevitable. One form of addiction or another has to come in that will numb you down. And that's what addictions do. They numb you out. Drugs numb you out. Alcohol numbs you out. Cigarettes numb you out. They kill you slightly. They dumb you down. They make things so you can't have all your intelligence. You can't have all your feeling because it becomes so intolerable when you have this other conditioning that says you almost don't deserve to live if you're wrong. This is the madness. This is the dysfunctional conditioning that causes us to get stuck and to not have the courage or have so much fear about facing ourselves because we'll see what we've done wrong. And of course, it's the other way around. All our freedom, all our wisdom, all our maturity, all our creativity, all our aliveness comes from being able to look at what we've done wrong, understand it, see its roots, see where it came from, see why we did it, gain and expand in understanding. This is why the show is called Trust the Problem, because it is the problem that always sets you up. So I say this to Mel and I say this to people at large, as people start to try to take up sides, being for or against them. Same is true of the president. How about if we just see this is, and you know, when I want to say it's an illness, you know, I have mixed feelings about alcoholism being called an illness. Of course it is, and on one hand it just truly is. You know, almost by any definition it is. On the other hand, it is a psychological problems can be illnesses. But we're more intolerant of something psychological being an illness than we are of something physical being an illness. And that's the part I think I'm sort of balking at or trying to put some light on. Because I do believe that by trying to make it just physical, we are once again being codependent. We are once again in denial of our own emotional responsibility, our own emotional trap of needing to be right. And, of course, the good thing about calling it an illness is that everybody lets up on that black and white mental judgmentalness and says, okay, let's just look at what this is. This is a disease. Let's try to heal it. And as I started to say here, I went online to look up the dry drunk thing, and I came upon an article that was written in 2002, September, by a man named Alan Bissart, who I guess has, you know, had family alcoholism in his family, and was looking at George Bush. And also, I think, you know, he points out that, here I have it right here in front of me, and he says, he's saying whether George Bush was or was not an alcoholic was not his point. He said, I'm taking him at his word that he stopped drinking what he termed heavy drinking in 1986 at age 40. The point is that based on his recent behavior, he's, you know, very well could be dry drunk. Of course, he may just be, the man says, he may just be an immature bully who will gladly sacrifice thousands of lives to get his way, even against the advice of the most respected members, mature members of his party. Well, that's making it more political than I want, but nonetheless, he's talking about George Bush's alcoholism and that when you are a recovering alcoholic, you begin to engage in what AA calls stinking thinking, and that you begin to exhibit the old attitudes and pathologies of the drinking years. So unpredictable mood swings. That covers just about 99.9% of everybody in the world right now. According to AA literature, boredom and listlessness may alternate with intense feelings of resentment against family and friends and explosive outbursts of violence. So this guy goes on to say in his article, Bush says he was a very heavy drinker. He said, but let's not be coy here. So, and he says something similar to what I've said. He said, anyone who's ever imbibed heavily over a long period of time knows that heavy drinker is just a rich man or politician's code for alcoholic. For the record, Bush claims to stop drinking for reasons that change each time he's asked about his substance abusing past. And, of course, this guy points out, which isn't often thanks to a cowed press. Let's say he started experimenting with alcohol as per the national norm at 16 in prep school, and he began drinking regularly, wasted at Yale. And I interrupt the quote here to say, I remember seeing a bio on George Bush when he was governor, running for president. It was on, I think it was Frontline, and they did one on Al Gore, and they did one on George Bush. And when he ran the second time, they edited out this piece, probably because of some protest. But what they had in this original documentary was roommates of George Bush's in college. And they like him. I mean, they were his friends. And they're being interviewed, and they almost affably say, you know, the way people do who drink too much sometimes, who think it's cool. He says, well, he said, you know, if you want to know how George was in college, he was the Jim Belushi character in Animal House. And I remember being so stunned and remember thinking, why is this not talked about more? Not so much that to be, you know, to, well, that too. I mean, that's so irresponsible. It's so out of hand. But that he continued to drink till he was 40. This is a terrible suppression of development. That's what alcohol does. It numbs you out to alleviate the pain, which is why they call it self-medication and all that in the community, in the jargon. And it is self-medication, but just like most medication, it can only be done sporadically, briefly, to get a leg up until you start facing things again. You have to stop. And mostly medication is just a way of numbing things out. Like I say, you can do it for a day to help you get your bearings when I'm talking about most medication. But anything that has to be taken chronically is a mask. It's a cover for not having to process the problem. And the reason medicine prescribes cover drugs is because they don't know how to solve the problem. And the reason they don't know how to solve the problem is because it requires facing what's wrong. And they have the same problems as their patients. The culture, America, humanity, has the same problems as the so-called patient. And this is part of why it turns into a catch-22, that you can't start facing it because the culture can't stand to see it. And so the most sensitive people often become addicted. I think one of the most releasing things is to really understand the full picture. So if you're a sensitive person and you're numbing out, go through the pain of seeing what's hurting you. Find someone to talk to be, to vent, not to dump, but to just let it out so it doesn't stay as a hurting loop inside, so that it comes out to the light of day where you really were hurt, where the parent you loved and respected and needed violated you because they were violated, because they were injured, and they dumped their injury and their violation on you. And sometimes it's just too hard to face. And it's so common. It's so almost inevitable. It's part of the ticket of being here. And when you're very sensitive and you're looking for a reason and your parents don't want you to see the reason as them, or a caretaker, or you're terrified, or all numbers of reasons why it gets hard to face. Just like America has trouble facing that they have contributed. They're not the only cause, but they have contributed to the pain in the Middle East. They have contributed to the danger that Iran is right now when they assassinated the first democratically elected president just because he tried to get along with the Soviet Union and the United States. And when Mossadegh was assassinated, we financed with arms and weapons and money the Shah to come in, our man, our puppet. And so he tortured people, or his secret police did, and he was cruel. And that caused more anger and more resistance. And then we got the Ayatollah. So it devolves. It gets more and more grievous, more and more black and white thinking, more and more pain, more and more violence, more and more blame. And there really is a difference between blaming and seeing what the cause is. Blaming has kind of got a connotation of just dumping it with a judgmental energy that closes the door and creates hate and pain and powerlessness. But if you see with clarity what was the cause, and it could be that, you know, the cause was very bad and very severe and something terrible and hard to face because of that. And that's the deadlock. That's the veil we have to lift. That's why it's so hard in America and in the world to face our addictions, and why we are addicted. Because we're addicted to power and appearances and secrecy and fantasy and illusion and delusion. And I can't tell you how many articles I've been reading just in the last couple of weeks and on television where people are saying, almost like in spite of themselves, like, well, it's as though Donald Rumsfeld is living in a delusion, or the president is. There is this illusion, delusion, wishful thinking, which is all characteristic of the dry drunk. I mean, you make up the reality you want to have, and anybody who challenges it becomes the enemy. This is the psychological core of fascism, of all kinds of ideological fanaticism, all kinds of needing to polarize and kill, vanquish, disappear any opposition. There's no maturity. There's no sensitivity to hearing the other person. The sensitivity has moved to a raw nerve of a person burned from head to toe, and anybody that touches them and it makes them scream and it's their fault, they don't realize they're the ones that are holding on to the burn and not healing the burn. And that we've all been burned, that we all carry some version of this, is just an inevitable fact in the stage of our development. And when we realize that, we can kind of relax and calm down and have compassion for other people while not sort of indulging or allowing the dysfunctional violation and violence that dry alcoholics and alcoholics and addictive personalities insist upon. And there was some other article, I'm so sorry, I can't remember who it was that I read about, and it was a man who was a recovered alcoholic, and he was saying that we have to have compassion for George Bush, but we have to totally not indulge what he's doing. We have to say what's true. And that's why I think at some point, you know, we do need to have hearings. We do need to see where we've been lied to, where the delusion is. Not for nailing George Bush, not for punishing him, but for causing things to become more healthy. And if we come from a punishing point of view, then we're just being the same dry drunk behavior. We're just projecting our own self-hatred at having been too weak to speak up in the first place. Too weak to have the courage, you know, when the brown shirts are on the road. There's this quality of waking up that has like two sides to the coin, and it goes from one extreme to the other extreme. So it's the extremist coin. It's extreme right, extreme left, all the same coin. It's polarized thinking. So it isn't so much that we're looking for the middle road. We're looking for the creative balance point changing. And this is part of what annoys old-style thinking, our immature conditioning, our youngness. We keep trying to find a place we can land where everything will be okay, everything will be right, and we just know how to look it up and do what's right, and then we'll be safe. It's as though we can't bear thinking for ourselves, because as soon as we have to think for ourselves, we have to take responsibility for what we think and what we do. And as we even try to do that, of course we try to do what's right. And I always would like to remind people, it's much more powerful to be good than to be right. It's much more enlightening, it's much more healing, it's much more profound, it's much more aligned with God. It allows things to move and to heal. And when we get judgmental, it deadlocks that growth, it deadlocks that process. That doesn't mean we can't and mustn't and need to keep making judgments. You have to keep making judgment, good judgment. And you use good judgment and you change it and you update it each moment when new information comes in and you expand it and you adjust it. But judgmental doesn't want to do that. It wants to just be right, nail it down, and not have to think anymore. And that's the secret of our immaturity. That's the secret of the way out, is that we have to see it's a deadlocking. It's a kind of locking it down. And that traps us into all our grief and pain, which builds a kind of rage and a fear of being this powerless, this injured, this hurt, that we tend to vent out on someone else, that we look for a scapegoat. And I used to say years and years ago, through all the time of years I've been doing these workshops, 35 years, I used to say, you know, that's one of the problems with Catholics and Jews, is that they're both so right. they're the chosen people. They've got the right religion. They're the ones that know. So it sets them up. It sets them up in themselves to be hurt because they are deadlocking the process. Humanity, we're all the children of God, my goodness. And if we just practice what all the great spiritual teachers have taught and stopped worrying about fighting over whose religion's better and how many angels can dance on the head of a pin and who's right and how it should be, if we look for the magic, if we look for the numinousness, if we look for the magic, not in magical thinking to blame, but for the numinous quality of inspiration, that's really connecting to God. That's a spiritual experience. That's real. Spirit is real. God is real. Connecting to that higher order of intuition and inspiration is the release point, the creative guidance. It's not ideology. It's not about looking at a book. You can look at a book. It can inspire you. Perhaps it can help. Perhaps. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that's not where the vitality is. That's not where the living next step is. It has to be done within ourselves. It has to be real. Otherwise, we're just wrapping ourselves in something. And we're claiming an arrogance and a grandiosity, which grows. And that's the symptom of the dry drunk. There's this grandiosity, this arrogance, this swagger, this overimportance. And of course, if you happen to be president of the United States, or probably one of the most famous movie stars in the world, it's really easy to just put that cloak on. Even when you, and I think Mel Gibson is much more mindful of this than the president is. And I think he even tries not to do that. People make it hard for him. He's always put in that box. And as he resents it and rejects it and tries to be bigger than it, he plays jokes, he fools around, but it really is all revealing a great grief. And to get back to Mel, and I apologize to him if I'm in any way invading his privacy, it's only public things, I'm not speaking from anything he personally has told me, but I am speaking from my personal experience of him. That I talked to him, even if it was briefly, and I heard him speak in person at a little length. And I know, I feel this in him. I feel the sensitivity, and I believe combination of things. Let me see if I can put it all in here. One, the Passion of the Christ is really about him. All that bloodiness, all that torture, all that sense of persecution is the wounds that he feels inside, that he's made this film to show. This isn't to say he thinks he's the Christ. We are all to be Christ, as Jesus said. We are all to be all of this and more. So it's not. I'm not talking about it in that. I'm not making a covert meaning in that way. But I mean, actually, as we try to embrace the God within us, Namaste, I salute the God in me, salutes the God in you. As we try to live that, in either we're thinking, it gets very grandiose. It gets into this crazy place because I used to like to say in my workshops, we're all a part of God. The thing we have to keep remembering is we're a very tiny, 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 small part of God. The universe is huge, and each of us is a part of God, and the whole universe is God. And so we're each small parts, and we're small parts disconnected from one another, trying to see one another, feel the universe, and integrate and grow and create. It's a creative act. It's a form of evolution. And this is what is God's greatest, I think, just astounding creation, is that he created all of us to be creators and to grow and to learn through mistakes, through taking something that misses it, and then through the resulting pain and dysfunction and realization, oh, this is a mistake. What else can we do? And our pain comes from getting stuck in trying to keep a mistake not a mistake. And our pain comes when we don't have a style of thinking that will allow us to make mistakes, see them as great signs for insight and creativity and another change and another step. Then we're aligned with spirit. Then we're aligned with what's healthy. Then we're aligned with growing and changing. And that's what we're about right now. That's what's happening. And it is a leap in consciousness. And I believe Mel Gibson has the capability to really get this with the necessary humility that always has to be there. You know, in AA, they talk about it in these articles I was reading about this, particularly this one man who, I'm so sorry I don't have it right here. If I find it, I will mention it, but he has a blog, and it's about, it's called The Principles. That'll probably get you in touch with it. He has principles that he's evolved out of the 12-step program. And one of the things I always liked about the 12-step program was, first you have to, the surrender to God, I didn't like exactly how they say it, because it comes from old-style thinking. It's said from that black-and-white place. But the truth is, when you realize God is everything, and you realize your place, you have surrendered. It's not like a Sieg Heil authoritarian, subservient personality surrendering to a stronger personality. That's the same drama. That's the same crazy, black-white, simplistic stuff. But when you really surrender, there is an acceptance of the flow. There is a rejoicing in the discovery, in the not knowing, in the adventure of discovery, that you don't get to run it. And I know from something else I read about, a quote from Mel Gibson, that he knows that. This is a little bit of the Celtic tale. And I'm going to just lighten this up slightly. Maybe it's not, I don't know. But I remember when I was in Ireland, and I did workshops there, and I was brought by some nuns, and I stayed at their house for 2 weeks, and I did workshops, and I was then visited this family, this young family with children, and a little village, so lovely, sweet people, good people, my gosh, my heart just so comforted, and they were talking about something I had said in the workshop, where I had said, you know, one of the things that made Ireland really different in the British Isles than Britain, than England, and Scotland, and Wales is that the Romans never got there, because in that early formative Middle Ages time, Rome, or pre-Middle Ages and post-Middle Ages, Rome obliterated a lot of the beautiful mysticism, the nature religion, the connection to God in everything, and the respect for nature, and the feeling of following that flow, a lot like Shintoism a bit in Japan, but it was this really beautiful, beautiful Celtic tradition and wisdom. And I was trying to say something about that in this workshop, and this lady raised her hand, and she said in a very wry Irish humor way, she says, "So are you talking about, so what finally got us was the Roman Catholic Church, eh?" And so what she was really saying is that the authoritarianism built into Roman Catholicism, which also is a combination of deep mysticism and deep healing spirituality, the symbols are beautiful, but the political organization is not always so beautiful. It's very human and it's very dysfunctional in many ways at many times. And I remember, as I've often said, being raised Irish Catholic, I went to Catholic school, and I remember after school I would go into the cathedral where I went to school across the street, and there'd be nobody there. And I would sit in the cathedral, and I'd look at the symbols, and I'd feel the stillness of the church and the beauty of the cathedral. And I would pray for the priests and the nuns, because they just didn't know. They didn't know how wonderful God was, because they wouldn't be so mean. They wouldn't be so confused. They wouldn't be so uptight. They would be more able to love. And I just realized it, you know, maybe I was only 8, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, but I knew it, and I could feel it, and it was completely clear, and it was sad, and very quietly telling no one, that's just what I did, I prayed for them. And so with these nuns that I stayed with, and this revelations that happened as we talked, I remember part of what I was saying in that one workshop, I said, you know, I recently was at a mass with the nuns that I was staying with, and the priest came in, did the mass in English, and the poor nuns sitting there in their now modern clothes, they didn't have the beautiful mysticism of the habits and the mystery to sort of stand behind and live up to, and they had their black skirts, white blouses, and black sweaters, and gold pins on their lapel, and they're mostly old ladies slumped over in their chairs. And the minister, the priest, comes and he gives the mass in English, and he says, in a very droning voice, he says, "And we celebrate the joy of Jesus Christ." And I remember I almost wanted to leap up and say, what are you doing? Where's the joy? Where's the celebration? I was beside myself. I mean, it was like a huge turmoil inside, and I'm looking at these poor nuns that have lost all the beauty, all the mysticism, and they're left with this despairing emptiness. It just seemed terrible. And then the next day I had to do the workshop. So I had this all in me, and I said at the same workshop that this lady said this when she brought up about the Roman Catholic Church, because I was making the point that Romans never got to Ireland and never put in that black-white, right-wrong, vis-a-vis adjudication, judgmental energy that all rode through to Rome, you know, all that power, control, domination, immature, linear mind stuff on this mystical, intuitively alive culture. And so then when I'm talking to this young family, as I started to say, I was telling her about how I felt it was so different, and that the Irish were different energy that had been held for many centuries. And then there was this great book about how the Irish saved civilization, and I thought it's because they held this intuitive yin, loving of nature, following the flow. That's it, you know, as I say all this stuff, by the way, don't misunderstand me. I know they are also very crazy, and like American Indians, who are also very beautiful in the same regard, have a very is very beautiful and it is very real, and linear-minded people almost hate it. They want to kill him right away. It's hard to bear. It's hard to see, because that innocence, like the innocence of a child, speaks to you, and it hurts you. It hurts you to see how cold you become. It hurts to see you disconnected. And so American Indians suffered this, you know, with the English and the people and the Irish and the Scotch and everybody, Germans and everybody else who invaded America and took away the land. They have the same problem. And when I say all this, again, I'm not over-idolizing them. They had their own craziness. They had their own immaturity. They had their own violence, their own faults by far and away. So I'm not doing that. It's not an either-or issue. But there was a quality of culture and thinking that was alive to the sensitivity of God in everything. And this is very important. This is a very important piece to make us sane. And alcoholism is, it's not unusual to me that the people who have cultural roots to this sensitivity become alcoholics, whether they're American Indians or Irish, Russians, black people taking drugs, whatever it is. This is a phenomenon that is traceable. This is an addiction to numb out the pain over the loss of connectedness. And it is, this is the gift they give us. And as they heal themselves, and it will be hard because they're living with this other energy. And when I say they, I mean you and me. I mean anyone listening. I mean all of us. Because we all have this dynamic in some way or another, because we've all mixed it up enough now that we're really all the parts. And some people are just more in one direction than the other, playing the role for us all to see. Getting back, you're trying to say this one little bit of the story about this young couple and children we're talking about. It's a simple little story. I don't know why it matters, but I was talking about all this that I just said about the sensitivity, and that most people who are very linear-minded disdain it, don't see it, persecute it. And she said, oh, you know, she said, it's true. She said, when the English came to Ireland, they instigated schools, and they put clocks in the classroom. And it seemed to us a kind of madness that you'd be talking about something and the clock would hit a certain hour and you'd have to stop talking about it, and then you'd have to go do something else. As she said, it was just so disheartening. And the Irish just never got it. You know, they just never were going to go along with that. And just intuitively, I used to make up the story many, many years ago after I first went to Ireland. And I'd been to England a number of times and done workshops in both places. And I said, used to say almost like a little joke in workshops, I said, if you want to know the difference between the Irish and the English, it's like if you're waiting in line and you're in England and you're in the wrong spot, or you're not, if you step ahead because you don't realize there's a line or whatever, everybody will get very huffy and look at you and say, there is a queue. Go to the back of the queue. And it'll be a kind of very, very judgmental, severe kind of nose-in-the-air energy. But if you're in Ireland and you go to the wrong place and there's a line, the Irish will say, ah, you mustn't be from here. Why don't you go to the head of the line? So there's this difference of expansiveness. And that's the difference between the yin mind and the yang. And unfortunately, or fortunately, we are immature and neither are very well developed. And our problems, our addictions, the crisis that is created is the dangerous opportunity to think bigger, to be forced to come to a crisis where there's a danger, it could get very bad, or God-given, glorious opportunity to transform and become more than what you were. And that's where I believe America and the world and each of us all is right now. And I believe that Nell is being an archetype, and I really do pray that he will. And I think he will. I mean, the quickness of his apology, the earnest choice of words were very good. I don't know if I have that available even to read to you, but you might go online or you'll hear about it probably in the news. But he wants to know, where did all that hate speak? spew out from that blaming and hatred? Well, it comes from old injury. It comes from great loss and loss of tenderness in his childhood that his father had. Even though he was a really wonderful man, he also had this great wound himself. And his mother died when he was very little, the father. And he was left in the care of people who were hard and very oriented into the church. And I'm not just saying the church's bad, because the church isn't all bad. It's got, it's a way, in a way, it's kept hold of great mystical metaphors. And even when they don't understand it and don't get it and don't practice it, the ideology holds on to the metaphor. So everything sort of has its place. But, and so if we could see the value and keep cultivating that which liberates, that which heals, that which brings light to reality, brings light to what's happening. If we do something dysfunctional, we say so. If we are working with someone who's a dry drunk, like we have a president and a whole administration, really, that's suffering from this problem, this is not an accident. This is like I don't know what I keep wanting to say. I use this metaphor and other things. It's like an abscess that comes to a head. You know, it's like all the pus has to come out so it can heal. We can't keep covering it up and pretend it's not there. And it's actually good when it comes to a head. And that's where we are. And we have to let everything come out. We have to treat it tenderly, gently, but we have to not cover it up. It's very important to not cover it up. You know, in the name of helping people not lose face. You help people not lose face when you have enough humility and consciousness and awareness to recognize there but for the grace of God go I. And in fact and indeed, there with the grace of God do go I, because I see you, I feel you, and I understand you, so in some level I've been there. Even if you haven't in this lifetime lived or done those actions, at some level, to know it and understand it, you have lived through it internally. And if you have been fortunate enough to process it, then you will be one of the energy frequencies that helps heal it. Because until it is processed, there is no real compassion, there is no real wisdom, there is no real maturity, and there is no real connection to God. This is why it's so important. This is part of our evolutionary leap. This is part of our maturity into the next level of being. This is where we are coming home to. And it is by facing all of this. And we could so end the problems in the Middle East. We could so end the environmental violations. We could have electric cars. We could have wind turbines out at sea generating hydrogen that come in boats into processing energy centers that, instead of being nuclear power plants or the electric power plant will be generated by the hydrogen that's created by the wind and the water and the sun, the climate, the whole system. It's natural. There's always a solution in nature. There is always the solution in nature. It's God writ large all around us. It's what we need to listen to and feel and extrapolate from. And the guide is what is healthy, what heals. It is such defective thinking. I heard some person on television just last night saying, it's compassion to go bomb the children in Lebanon because we have to stop Hezbollah. It is not compassion to bomb the children in Lebanon because you have to stop Hezbollah. If you want to stop Hezbollah, see the Hezbollah in you. And begin to correct it and start making things better. Then the violence and the violation and the matching energy in the Hezbollah, in Israel, in anywhere you want to think of, you know, you start reducing the tension when you process what's in you. And because to truly process it, not cover it up, not come up with a new ideology, but actually process it, you become a new person and your energy is different and you can absorb dysfunction and transform it merely by existing. It isn't it isn't even a big, glorious, heroic thing, though in some way it is, but it isn't really. It's just healthy. As my son used to say when he was little, and I used to describe these wonderful things we could do, he said, "What do you mean be normal, Mom? Be normal." For children, you know, being holy and being whole and being healthy and being honest and being innocent, being kind and being helpful is utterly normal. When they don't behave that way, it's their desperate attempt to adapt to a culture and to people around them who are not doing that and who are demanding that that innocence and that tenderness and that gentleness be stopped because it shows them up. And this is the problem. This is why there is so much antichrist in Christianity, so much against Christ's teaching. Not lived. It's not lived. If it's lived, it's transformative. I think it was Thomas Jefferson who said, if we all lived as Jesus taught, we'd all be Christians. But you wouldn't even need to have the title. You'd just be living that way, and it would be good. And that's what Jesus taught, that you just live it. Not that you go around killing people in the name of, or judging them, or hating them, or ostracizing them. So this is the transformation. This is the evolutionary leap. We're going to realize what Buddha meant, what Muhammad meant, what Jesus meant. We're going to realize the best. We're going to remember that when Christianity was cruel and persecuting and sadistic, Islam was enlightened and tolerant and kind and scientific. Let's have some compassion. Let's look at what is and see how it's evolved. And as we do that, we transform ourselves and we heal the world. So this is actually, you know, this is really the story. This is how you trust the problem. You see it by healing yourself, by seeing the bigger picture, by seeing how we're all connected, by cultivating the link to that which is greater, with inspiration, with insight, with self-correction, with forgiveness. And when people don't forgive you, you forgive them for not forgiving you, and you continue on your way, healing and doing what is good. This is the solution. Don't get into the angst of punishing or being punished. Move to the consciousness beyond that. That's the evolutionary leap. And that's trusting the problem. I want to thank you so much for being with me. And I hope that today is an inspiration and lifts the veil somewhat, because I think that's right where we are. Thank you so much. This is Patricia Sun. If you'd like to know more about my work, patriciasun.com, and I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.
You've been listening to Trust the Problem with Patricia Sun. This program and its content is copywritten to Patricia Sun, all rights reserved, 2006.